All right, so we this week are slated to start a new sefer, Parshas Vayikra and Sefer Vayikra, and we're missing doing that in shul once again, unfortunately. For us here, it's the third straight week, and it kind of highlights one of the main themes of the sefer and our relationship to it. And it's a somewhat complex point that here, Sefer Vayikra is a very fascinating sefer. A lot of it, particularly as we get a little bit further in, a lot of principles of mitzvos ben adam l'chaveiro and of chesed and the like are found within Sefer Vayikra. And of course, the first part of it is largely focusing on themes of karbanos and the avodas beis hamikdash. In English and Latin, they call the sefer Leviticus, as it focuses on the avodas halevim and the kohanim. And it's a topic which is a little bit abstract for us. And sometimes the details can be hard for us to relate to and to connect to. And yet, that's actually an opportunity for us because we don't have a Beis HaMikdash today. And we feel this even more acutely now because we don't even have a Beis Knesset today at the moment. And the whole of our experience in the modern era of relating to themes like Sefer Vayikra, really it was true about a lot of the content of the second half of Shmos as well, is that we have to relate through study instead of through performance. And this is a notion that we have, and Mishnah tells us in the end of Maseches Menachos. We'll have a little more to say about that next week where it comes up as well. But the notion of Neshalma Parim Sfoseinu, that in the absence of being able to bring the Karbanos, we need to compensate for our missed opportunities or our lack of opportunities through the study of these topics. And that's what that Mishnah tells us at the end of Menachos, that kol ha'osek b'taras ola ki'ilu hikriv ola, kol ha'osek b'taras chatas ki'ilu hikriv chatas, that we have the opportunity to try to experience the value of the karbanos through studying about it, and we also relate to that through tefillah, that our tefillah is the replacement for the karbanos. And this week we have to replace the replacements. We're not going to be able to meet in shul and to lane the psukim of Vayikra and to daven as a tzibur, but we have to try to do whatever we can to try to focus on how we can make up for this through study. And the idea that study is a fulfillment, that the Limud HaTorah can also allow us to fulfill some aspect of the mitzvah. It's an interesting discussion to what extent this is something that is unique to the Karbanos, or is this something that is true b'chol Torah kula? Let's say if somebody is prevented from doing any other mitzvah, let's say it's a sukkah and somebody's on a desert island, and he doesn't have a lulav or esrog. It's one of these interesting islands where he doesn't have a palm tree, but he does have a shulchan aruch, or he has a safari with a good Wi-Fi connection, so he's able to learn hilchos lulav. So can he fulfill the mitzvah by learning about it? So there were some who said, yeah, this is true, b'chol Torah kula, that you can learn about a mitzvah when it's not possible to fulfill it. And that's also a key of a mitzvah. The Rekech is quoted along these lines. Ephraim Greenblatt has a tshuva where he discusses the concept of tayag. It happens to be Simon Tayag in one of his tshuvas, where he says, if No one has all of Tayrig Mitzvahs apply to them. So how do any of us fulfill Tayrig Mitzvahs? And he suggests, based on this idea, that through learning about the mitzvah, it's as if we fulfill the mitzvah. That's how all of us have the opportunity to fulfill Tayrig Mitzvahs. But there are many who understood that this is a concept that is distinct for Korbanos, and that is how the Chafetz Chaim explained in the Hakdama to his Sefer Likutei Halachos. The Chafetz Chaim put together a Sefer, which is good to know about, especially if you want to spend some of the time these weeks going into greater depth about the concepts of the Korbanos. So the Chafetz Chaim wrote a somewhat Mishneh Berurah style Sefer on the Korbanos. We don't have certain Rishonim on the Korbanos who focused more on Halacha L'maisa, so we don't have a riff on most of Kadshim. So the Chafetz Chaim wrote a riff style Sefer bringing down the Gemaras that need a Psak, and he then wrote a two-tiered commentary on it. All of this put together in the Sefer Likutei Halachos, and there in an introduction he explains that he thinks this idea of learning about the Korbanos and that being considered a fulfillment, this is something which is unique to the concept of Korbanos. He also felt that it was practical that we have to be ready, that Meher Yibana HaMikdash, and that we have to assume that at any minute the Beis HaMikdash could be returned to us, and we have to be ready. We have to know practically what needs to be done. And that spirit of optimism and looking towards our redemption, especially now as we just welcomed in today Chodesh Nisan, a month of Geula, and all of us are feeling most acutely how much we need a redemption. So to be able to look towards the future and to be able to have that kind of focus, it makes the study of the Korbanos even more powerful for us this week. And especially if one does feel like the Chafetz Chaim feels, that this idea that the study can accomplish its goals, if that is unique to Kadshim, so then all the more so, this is something which really speaks to us at this point. And together with our need to even go further and making up for what we don't have the Tefillah B'Tzibur, we don't have the public Kriyas HaTorah, so to really try to do everything we can to connect to these themes is a particular opportunity that we need to do as much as we can to try to realize and to try to maximize. So we, over the course of this weekend, will try to be ma'ayin in the themes of Parshas Vayikra as much as possible, with our recognition that there is this additional kiyum, there is this additional component that comes with this study. And if we do assume that it is something that is specific to our Korbanos, so the notion that our Korban is about coming close and that Talmud Torah is about coming close, and maybe it's this area of halacha specifically that there is an opportunity to accomplish its goal through study. We know that we look at the Talmud Bavli, so the Talmud Bavli doesn't have any Gemara on certain areas. So we don't have Taras and we don't have Zrayim, because these are not observed in the times of the Amoraim and Bavel, so therefore they didn't study them to the same extent, and we don't have Gemaras on this, as opposed to the Yerushalmi we have Zrayim, all the Masechtas that the Bavli didn't comment on, because in Eretz Yisrael, Zrayim was practical, and in Bavel, it wasn't. But in Bavel, we do have, in the Bavli, we do have Kadshim, we do have Gemaras on Zvachim, Aminachas, and Bukharis, and Erchim, and all these Masechtas. And it seems to reflect this idea that even the mitzvot that aren't being practiced, so when it comes to Kadshim, there's a special status within that when it comes to the Korbanos. And studying the themes of the Korbanos is a particular focus, may not be true by other areas that weren't practiced, such as Taras and such as Rav and Chutz La'aretz, didn't necessarily get the same attention. Ironically, perhaps we don't have a Kutchum in the Ushalmi, and that was the subject of a fascinating hoax about 100 years ago. Somebody claimed to have discovered a Yerushalmi Kutchum, and it's a pretty impressive thing to be able to pull that off, because many great Talmidei Chachamim did, at least for some period of time, thought that there was a possibility that was real. That's really Madrega, to be able to falsify a Seder of Shas and to convince some Talmidei Chachamim that it's some great Talmidei Chachamim that it was something to pay attention to. It's a pretty sophisticated trickery. I don't really know what to say about that. But one way or another, so we do have a Kutchum in the Bavli, and maybe it reflects that fact. So on the one hand, to Davka at a time when we don't have the ability to bring Karbanos, and Davka at this specific moment in history when we're even further removed from some of what we do to replace the Karbanos, so it creates a bigger focus on our obligation to study these themes with some depth and some attention. But there's another aspect to it also, and that is that maybe even more so than other areas of halacha, when we look at the karbanos or when we look at the components of the Mishkan that we read about the past few weeks, so there is a tremendous amount of symbolism that is contained within the many, many details that we have presented before us. And especially when we don't relate to a mitzvah practically, when we don't have the opportunity to actually carry out its details in real life, so then the role that it has as symbolism and the role of the details in conveying to us various messages becomes even more significant. And therefore, that's also something to pay attention to give even greater focus to the symbolism of the details of the Karbanos, so that we can try to appreciate that and that we can try to incorporate the messages into our own lives. That's even greater opportunity to be able to try to do that, to try to relate to this on a symbolic messaging level, and to look carefully at the details and see what we can learn from them. And General Maramakum would mention that the writings of Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch tend to be particularly detailed in these areas, that in the areas of the details of the Mishkan and Klei HaMikdash and the Karbanos, he often has a lot of insight and a lot to say, and I would particularly recommend looking at his writings over the course of these parashios. And the question of symbolism of the Karbanos and the role that the Karbanos play within Jewish Hashkafa is the topic of a major machlokas that the Rambam, in a few places in Mor Nevuchim, in the third section of the Mor Nevuchim, so the Rambam has a understanding of Karbanos that was a topic of dispute, because the Rambam seems to focus on the Karbanos as more of a reaction, that the other religions had this concept of animal sacrifice, and that what we're doing as a sacrifice, as a sacrificial order, not so much that it's there for anything of its own inherent value or symbolism, but it's there, lahitzi miliban, it's there essentially to fight what the idolaters were doing. And he has this in two different ways. One way is that they were involved in animal sacrifice, so therefore the Jews had a hard time conceiving of a religion that didn't have animal sacrifice, and we just have to have it, therefore, in order to create a context that the Jews who came from that environment would be able to relate to. Or elsewhere, he has a different point of focus, that the animals that we would sacrifice, the bulls and the sheep and the cows, these are animals that the Egyptians and other religions, they worship these animals. So like, this is certainly very much part of the symbolism of the Karban Pesach at the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim, to take the gods that were worshipped by these religions and instead of worshiping them, to sacrifice them. So that's a big statement to counter the impact and the influence of those religions. So the Ramban, and his commentary here in the Chumash, in the first parak of Vayikra, so the Ramban is very upset about this. He doesn't think that this is correct. He says we find all kinds of indications that the korbanos do have inherent value in Jewish philosophy. The Torah talks about them having a reach nichoach, having an aroma that is pleasing to Ribbono Shalom, which suggests that they have their own inherent value. And we find it as part of the Torah, even going back to the very beginning of creation, the very beginning of human history with Cain and Hevel and with Noah, and we find the korbanos throughout. So the Ramban felt that this was not an acceptable approach, and that the korbanos certainly do have inherent meaning, and there are various ways to explain that meaning. And the Ramban talks about identifying with the animal being sacrificed and feeling essentially there, but for the grace of God go I, that this animal is being brought in my stead, especially when we focus on Korban Chatas, for example. So the idea that instead of me dying, so this animal is dying instead of me, and what kind of feelings does that arouse? So this was a major debate between the Rambam and the Ramban as far as the question of the symbolism of these korbanos and to what extent there is inherent meaning and symbolism of the korbanos. So the Meshech Chachma has a pshara, sort of, in his commentary to Chumash, where he suggests that maybe there's a distinction to be drawn between the time of the bamos and later, that when there was a heter bamos, which we don't have anymore and we'll never have again. So therefore, even the Rambam doesn't talk about this concept. The bamos are the private mizbechos that people would have in their backyard. And it was, once upon a time, it was mutter for people, for Jews, to bring korbanos privately. And once there was a central location for the korbanos, once there was a place of mikdash, so then there was no longer a heter bamos. And it never will be again. So when you learn Masech Zvachim, and if you want to try to find Rishonim to help you go through the details of the Masechta, so as I mentioned before, there's no riff, there's no rush. Some of the Halacha Maisa Rishonim are not talking about these Masechtas because they weren't practiced in their time, but the Rambam is different. The Rambam wrote the Mishnah Torah. He included all the halachos that will be relevant to lots of Lavo as well. But the bamos he doesn't talk about because the bamos are not going to have a heter ever again. So we learn the end of Zvachim, which is a bad bamos. You have a hard time finding any Rishon to really help you through the Gemara because there's very little that's written about that. Not even the Rambam writes about it. So Meshech Chachma suggests that maybe the bamos were a concession. The bamos were there as a temporary method to try to counter the impact of the sacrifices, the way the Rambam formulated it. But then after that, so the kavua concept of korbanos for the Beis HaMikdash and for the Mishkan, so that is something that we have to assume is intentional and inherent to the values of Judaism. Some will relate this Rambam as if the Rambam is saying that Los Lavo were not going to have korbanos because they were only tied to a certain period of time. That's difficult to say because the Rambam, as we mentioned, the Rambam does record all the rules of the korbanos in Mishneh Torah as opposed to the bamos, creating the impression that he does feel this is going to be a part of practical halacha Los Lavo. There is a view attributed to Rav Kook that Rav Kook felt that the highest spiritual plane is one in which adults will be vegetarians, where we're not going to kill animals for our own purposes, even our own holy purposes, that Los Lavo, maybe there won't be animal sacrifices, and that there will only be menachos, And that's why we say in the tefillah of Arva LaHashem Minchas Yehuda v'Yerushalayim. It's a quotation from the pasuk. We say that we look towards the time when the menachos, when the food offerings, will be pleasing to God. So what about the zvachim? What about the animal sacrifices? So his understanding was that maybe we're not going to have animal sacrifices in the future, and that's a controversial perspective as well. But the idea that the Rambam has, that it was this type of reaction, shouldn't necessarily be interpreted to mean that the Rambam thinks that we're not going to have animal sacrifices in the future, because the impression we would have from Mishneh Torah is that these are halachos which are someday going to be relevant again. Simcha Zussel Vroid in the Sandarach, so he discusses that maybe also within the Rambam you could say that they started off as a counter of Avodah Zarah practice, but through that, that's how it became meaningful. That's how it came to have its own inherent significance. And that it's kind of the inverse of what you find by Sor and Dvash. We find by certain things that were used for Avodah Zarah become negative after being neutral or positive. They become negative. So maybe the Karbanos took the opposite path, that starting off, as far as Jews are concerned, as a counter-idolatry measure, that's how they became meaningful. And therefore, that's something which could then ultimately have its own chavivus, l'fnei hamakom, something which could be considered cherished by God because of its steps taken to distance the world from idolatry, and that itself is a reason for it to have inherent meaning. So there are various perspectives on how we relate to the whole concept of the karbanos and what exactly they mean for us. But one way or another, again, in the absence of being able to actually carry them out, and in the absence of even being able to publicly lay about them or to have tefillah b'tzibur, so this is a time when we really want to pay close attention to the study of these sukkim and to find whatever symbolic meaning may be contained therein, and that's important for us. In general, reciting the karbanos every day is more important than people appreciate, and that at least certain basics, the Talmud and the Ketores, we need to recite more important than Psukei de Zimra, which many people don't necessarily appreciate, they think, when they have to skip. Hopefully, you know, nowadays, that if we can't go to shul in Shachar, so at least we're able to take a few more minutes, hopefully, to daven and to say everything. But when we're late in the morning, or when we are able to go to shul, we're behind, so we need to cut things. So people often think that, okay, so Psukei de Zimra is more important than the Karbanos. Rabbi Isaac Bernstein, Zichron Lebracha, is quoted as saying that they're called the sacrifices because they're the first thing to go when you're late, the first thing to be sacrificed. Because people assume, okay, saying the Karbanos is not so important. But as Rabbeinu Yona emphasizes, and Schechter often points this out, that the Karbanos are actually more important than Psukei de Zimra. To say Psukei de Zimra every day is a Mila, so a good Mila, but to say Karbanos, especially in the absence of the Beit HaMikdash, to say Karbanos seems to be a higher priority. And the Gemara tells us in Masechet Tanis and in Masechet Megillah that Avraham Avinu, when he asked the Ribono Shel Olam, and says, how will I know that my descendants will inherit, and God here is promising that his descendants will inherit the land, and Moshe and Avram still asking, how do I know what's going to happen? So the Gemara explains that his question was that maybe my descendants will mess up, maybe they'll sin, and maybe they will lose their schus to the land. So that was his question. So God says, okay, so we can deal with that. That Yavi Karbanos Yiskapit, they'll be able to bring the Karbanos, and that will bring about an atonement. And Avraham Avinu is sharp, and he realizes that maybe we won't always have a context for that, but what if there's no Beis HaMikdash? in which to bring the korbanos. So then the response is, okay, they'll learn about the korbanos, and that will be their replacement. So it highlights the fact that we really have a chiyuv to be saying the korbanos every day, and presumably this should be true for women also, that this is an aspect separate from the whole Talmud Torah for women discussion, that this Talmud Torah as a fulfillment in the korbanos that we don't have brought on our behalf in the Beis HaMikdash today, so all the more so this is something that should be seen as obligatory, should be seen as a part of our daily avodah, of our daily expression, and that's something that we need to take on. The Soloveitchik often addressed the question, this is something Rav Schechter quotes often as well, that maybe there's an additional component that from the perspective of Talmud Torah, that maybe there's even a greater kiyum than other areas of Talmud Torah. If one's going to learn Zvachim, one's going to learn Menachos, as opposed to, let's say, learning Maseches Megillah or Maseches Brachos, that maybe there's a greater kiyum Talmud Torah in learning Zvachim and Menachos. So why is that? Because if you learn Brachos or if you learn Maseches Megillah, so a lot of the content of those Masechtas involves Dinim Derabbanan. A lot of it is about rabbinic law. And if you learn Kachin, so there's very little rabbinic law, because most of it takes place in the Beis HaMikdash, where we generally don't have so much rabbinic legislation. We say that the Kohanim are his reason, and they don't need so much rabbinic help to make sure that they don't make mistakes. So much of the content of Zvachim and Menachos is about Dinim Daraisa, and much of the content of Brachos and Megillah, something like that, is going to be about Dinim Darabbanan, and most other Masechtas will be somewhere in between. So maybe you should say that if you're going to learn about Dinim Darabbanan, so that's only a kiyum of Talmud Torah Midarabbanan. You're not learning about the actual details of the Chumash. So maybe this is not a full kiyum in Talmud Torah. Maybe we should spend all our time learning Zvachim and Menachos, like they do in Brisk, because that way you will have a real fulfillment of Talmud Torah Min HaTorah. So Soloveitchik didn't accept that premise as much as he discussed it. And he said that we understand that the study of Dinim Darabbanan is a fulfillment of Talmud Torah D'Oraisa, that this becomes a part of a Chesed Shel Torah, and this is just something that's particularly relevant to us this man, where we are spending so much time focusing on the relationship between the Daraisas and the Darabbanans and Basa B'chalav, and we spent a lot of time on the background of how Dinim Darabbanan work. So it's important just to appreciate that once Chazal come and create these Dinim, so then that's also called Talmud Torah, even a level Daraisa. But the Avamina was that maybe Zvachim Menachos, maybe we should spend all our time on that, because we'll then spend all of our focus on the actual dinim of the Torah and not the dinim that were created by the rabbis. Okay, so that happened, and we don't accept. But for all the other reasons, so to learn Zvachim and Menachos is a fulfillment of many levels, and to learn the psukim of Parshas Vayikra and part of Sefer Vayikra is a special opportunity with entire dimensions that are different than maybe other aspects of the Torah. And also true that it directs our focus towards themes of purity, and it's also why there's a tradition, which I don't know how much we find this really fulfilled nowadays, but it's an old tradition that we know about, that the young children, their first introduction to the Torah, it was through these themes, Yavo Taharim, V'yisasku V'taharim, let those who are pure and unblemished spend their time studying these themes of purity. And also add that in this particular tkufa, where we have to be so hyper-vigilant about what we touch and who we speak to and who speaks to who and how they speak to and where they stand, that the themes of Tumah V'Tahara and the great care and diligence and vigilance that we need in order to maintain a protection from any kind of contagion or infection, the ability to connect to that even more during this tkufa is very real, and that also can be part of the background that's with us as we study some of these themes of Korbanos. So all of that is really a begadder introduction. We haven't opened up the Chumash yet. We haven't looked at any of the Tzukim, so we'll just spend a few minutes doing that. But we will try to do that a little bit now. But all of this was important to give us a little bit of context and a little bit of background to what Kadshim and Sefer Vayikra and Parshas Vayikra have to offer us. So to begin now with the actual Tzukim, so we find, to open up here, so we find the first word of the Sefer and of the Parsha is Vayikra. The Torah tells us, Vayikra el Moshe, Vayidaber Hashem Elov, Me'ohel Moed Lemor. So Moshe was called out to by God, and God spoke to him from the Ohel Moed. So here the Gemara, in the beginning of Masechet Yuma, and the Abdalid, the Gemara tells us that you see that it's Derech Eretz to call first, to call out to somebody when you're going to speak to them. You don't just launch into a conversation. Try not to spring on people things at all. Try not to be sudden in our interactions and in our communications. But it's proper Derech Eretz to call out to somebody first. Okay, so we know also that in the Sefer Torah, so the word Vayikra is written in an unusual way, that the Aleph is small, and that the Aleph is minimized, and the Baal Turim suggests that the idea is that Moshe wanted to kind of create a different impression about his relationship here. That here God is giving him this kavod, this honor of addressing him directly. And if you look at somebody like Bilam, so the Torah uses the language of a yikra, that it's as if it just happened to him. It's just as if it was a circumstance, a happenstance. And Moshe wanted to look like that. He wanted to create a more humble impression of the nature of his relationship, and therefore he tried to write the Aleph in a way that it shouldn't be noticed, which is an interesting idea on a number of levels. The Oznayim LaTorah, the Lutzker Rav, has a different suggestion here, that maybe it's to show that his enthusiasm to respond and the contrast to his initial relationship with God one Sefer ago, at the beginning of Sefer Shmos. So, you know, God was calling on Moshe for a mission, and Moshe didn't want to do it. He was hesitant. He was reluctant. And here, you know, we find, that's where we find the word Vayikra also there as well. It's another time we find God calling out to Moshe. So here, Moshe is responsive in a whole different way. And we see he doesn't even wait for the end of the Kriya, that he starts to respond before the word can even be finished. Maybe that's how we're supposed to interpret that the end of this word is rushed, is not fully formed, in order perhaps to convey that message. It says that Vayikra El Moshe, and that God then spoke to him, Vayidaver Hashem Elov. So there is a observation here again in that Gemara in the beginning of Yuma, that Moshe was spoken to directly, and he heard God's call from inside the Ohel Moed, and the Jews were in between, they didn't hear, they couldn't hear this, only Moshe could hear this. So the Chafetz Chaim has a comment here, which is quoted in a number of places, who happens to make reference to it also, that sometimes the Torah describes things that are miraculous and that are me'al ha'teva, and we can't relate to how it would work. And then technology comes and creates something that all of a sudden we can relate, and we are able to then understand what was being described. So So he quotes this as an example that here the Torah is describing that God is calling out to Moshe, and there are people in between Moshe and the Olmoid, and they can't hear, and Moshe farther away, he can't hear. So how could you imagine such a thing? It doesn't work. So then they came and they invented the telephone, and then we could understand that it's possible for somebody to speak in one place, and he can be heard in a different place, and the people in between don't necessarily hear. The sound is just transmitted from A to B, and not all the points in between. So sometimes this is very pro-technology. Sometimes that technology is able to help us understand the Torah in ways that we had to wait for it to come along in order for us to be able to appreciate. And we know there's so many other ways in which we see that. So in the internet era, the idea that everything, when the Chazal tell us that everything we say is written down, are called nichsav v'pinkas, everything is recorded, everything can come back to testify and how we behave, good or bad. So now we live in an era where that's really demonstrable, where we see that. And that also helps us to appreciate an aspect that we couldn't necessarily relate to before. And to focus on where we're at right now again, you know, this idea of this tiny little bug that can have a stranglehold on our lives also is able to help us relate to certain concepts that we read about in Shas and in Chumash, and appreciate just how much we can see and yet is able to have a tremendous impact on how the world functions. It's also a very sobering and humbling part of that message, how our advanced technological awareness creates a whole new ability to understand and to appreciate some aspects of what is conveyed to us in the Torah and what's conveyed to us in Shas. Okay, there's another point, again, that Gemara and Yuma and Naftalid also makes another point about this pasuk, that the pasuk ends with the word lemor, that Moshe is told this to say, and the Gemara understands that you see from here that anything that somebody tells you, you have to assume that it's together baltomer, that it is on the category of you don't have a right to repeat it, unless they go out of their way to come and tell you that it is true, that, I mean, that it is something you can repeat, rather, that it's something that you have permission to say over to other people. Otherwise, you should assume that everything that you're told is together baltomer, which is a powerful statement about confidentiality and about respecting the privacy of what people tell you. Here, many of the Rishonim understand, as the Meiri and others who talk about this, that they understand that this is not an absolute din, it's not an actual iser, but it's more of a midas chasidus, that you should take everything as automatically confidential. There's a tshuva about this, and the tshuva is Vitel HaChachma, Vitel Stern, and others who get into the details about this, that if somebody tells you that something is confidential, and or if the context makes it clear that what somebody tells you is confidential, so then for sure there's an iser to repeat what you were told. That's together lashon hara, it's together megalosod, which is considered to be a aspect of rechilus. So if we have a prohibition, we'll say l'chrachol b'yamecha. So that means we can't tell stories about people. Also means that we can't reveal their secrets. So if something is clearly confidential, if it's identified as confidential, or if the context makes it obvious that it's confidential, so then there's a prohibition of gilui sod. What we're talking about here is a step beyond that, that he hasn't said that it's confidential, but that you should wait for explicit permission to repeat something, to lay more. So that may be a midas chasidus, it may not be an actual love, but it's an extra level of care that you want to make sure that you are given permission to share what you're told. One way or another, this is a detail Refilus detail Hilchos Lashon Hara, which means not absolute. So if there is a situation of Toelet, if there's a situation where you need to reveal something because of Leisamad Al Dam Reyecha, and this is also something very relevant to this particular Tkufa, where there are issues regarding people's health that sometimes one person may not want you telling somebody else, but it impacts on the safety or the protection of others. So then we have a imperative of Leisamad Al Dam Reyecha, that we can't let somebody get hurt. And that's a heter and a chiyah for Lashon Hara, and this is from the same category. So Gilui Sod will also be sometimes necessary in order to protect others, but by default, min hastam, it doesn't involve protecting others, so that's an aspect of Lashon Hara. And here, the Pasuk is telling us an extra mila, that even if you haven't been told explicitly that something is confidential, that it's better, al pi darach eretz, it's better to wait until you're told explicitly that it's shareable, that it's something that you're able to convey. This is also something which has greater relevance in the digital era, because we get messages from people and we very casually forward them and copy them, and sometimes we have not such great intentions in doing so. Sometimes we're actually trying to embarrass the person who sent something, but often it's more innocent. But still, it's not something that we should take as a given, that we can always do. You can just forward whatever anybody sends to you. That this, at least the midas chasidus of being careful with what people share with you, and understanding that you really should wait for permission before giving that to anybody else. That's something to recognize and to appreciate, is one of the values that's being conveyed here. Okay, so as we look at the next pasuk, I'm trying to get at least towards the second pasuk here. So the pasuk says, "Daber el bnei Yisrael v'amarta aleihem." So what should you tell the Jews? Adam ki yakriv mikam korban Hashem min behema min abakar min hason takrivu as korbanchem. So if any one of you want to bring a korban, so you should bring the korban from these animals. And here there are various limudim that convey to us that whatever we bring shouldn't be min hagezel. And it's very striking that out of all the many halachos of karbanos, that, as I mentioned, the details are tremendous in these huge mesechtas and many, many psukim telling us about the rules of the sacrifices. So essentially, this is the first one. Chazal understands in a few different ways that there is a prohibition of bringing korbanos min hagazel, from something that you're going to steal and to offer up as a korban. So that's something which is off limits. And it's not only off limits, it is really the first din that we're told about here in korbanos. How do you see it from the pasuk? You see it a few ways. Some point to the language of mikem, that you could only bring a korban from that which is yours and not that which you are stealing from someone else. Chazal also points to the fact that Adam is invoked here in order to remind us of Adam Harishon. So you see Rashi has a comment, Adam Laman Amar, Ma Adam Harishon Lo Hikriv Min Hagazel, that Adam didn't bring korbanos from Gazel, Shakol Hayashal, anything that he had access to was his anyway, so there was no Gazel. Afa Tavlo Yisakruv Min Hagazel, so you shouldn't bring from Gazel either. So whether it's from Mikad or from Adam, one way or another, so we see here a opening halacha in Hilchos Korbanos, that we're not supposed to bring anything that's a violation of Gezel, anything that's stolen. And this is true on many different levels. We have a notion of mitzvah habavi avera, that we can't do a mitzvah through the commission of an avera. It turns everything on its head. And again, that's also a greater sensitivity that we have nowadays. You know, we have a desire to be making minyanim and to be doing things that will allow us to fully express our spirituality, but we can only do that al pidin. And if it's a sakana to do so, and if it's going to hurt people and put people at risk, And if the rabbinate is telling us we're not allowed to do that, so then the halacha isn't allowing it. And to think that you can perform a mitzvah through an avera is a fallacy, and this should be something that we should understand logically is not possible. And that's a little bit the focus here also, that there's this notion of the mitzvah habah the avera in general. But it's also true that as much as it's relevant to mitzvahs overall, but it's also particularly relevant to something like karbanos, that if karbanos are about ritzui, so they're about making God happy, to be also whatever that means, so then all the more so, and this is what some of the Rishonim understand, that the mitzvah habah v'avera concept is particularly relevant when you have a mitzvah that's beyond every other mitzvah. So every mitzvah is God's command that we're doing because he asked us to, but there are some mitzvahs that have a particular focus of ritzui, that are there, so to speak, to appease God. That's how some of the Rishonim understand, that you find in the context of lulav, that the lulav and etrog is a mitzvah like every other, but it also has this component of being there to be meratza God, of being there to win him over, so to speak. So there, we're even more sensitive to the idea that any kind of an avera should be mixed in. That's something which clearly undermines the whole project. And it's striking also that when you learn all the many, many details of Hilchos Lulav, as is presented in Shas, in the Mishnayos, and in the Gemaras, so many pratim to keep track of. But the very first din is Lulav HaGazel Pasul. The very first din is that a stolen Lulav is no good. It seems to be a opening theme, especially for the Karbanos. This is the first din that we learn in the Karbanos. And this is also the first din that we learn in the context of Lulav and Etrog, about Ritzui also, that we have to have this sensitivity not to try to be meratza God with an avera. But there's an additional element here also, and that particularly when it comes to karbanos, so the notion that we could have any type of gezel brought towards a karban is especially illogical. And it really undermines the whole theme in a way that completely turns everything on its head. Because if somebody were to steal something and then offer it as a korban to God, so on top of everything else of mitzvah habah v'avera, and on top of what kind of a way is that to try to win over God, on top of all of these other issues, it would really show a very dangerous misunderstanding of what karbanos are about. Because you can imagine, what's the mentality of somebody who would steal something and then give that as a karban to God? So then what does that say about his perception of karbanos? I mean, what does that tell us? It means he must think that, what are karbanos there for? Karbanos are there because God needs the gift. God needs the food. So if I am able to get him a nice animal, then he'll enjoy that animal. And it's worth even stealing it, because this is such an attractive animal, this is such a tasty animal, that God will appreciate the gift, it'll be worth it for him. So obviously that's ludicrous. We're not bringing God karbanos because we think he needs them, because we think he needs the animal. The idea is it's supposed to say something about our devotion and about our readiness to sacrifice to God. And if we think that there's any logic at all to, oh, look, that guy's got something nice, I'll steal it and I'll give it to God, so then in addition to every other problem, it reflects an understanding of karbanos, which is completely backwards. It means that you think that God needs this gift, and that maybe there's some justification in acquiring it through theft in order to provide him what he needs. So it turns the whole concept of karbanos on its head. And it reminds us that it's not about him, it's about us, that this is supposed to represent what we are offering and what we are sacrificing. So once again, in our very compromised circumstances, we recognize that whatever we're trying to accomplish, it's not for God's sake. God does not need us to endanger other people or to act illegally in order to provide something for Him. He needs us to do what we can in our circumstances to most accurately reflect how our relationship is being carried out. And that's going to have to happen within the structure of whatever we're provided. And it's also a very powerful and important reminder of the value system as we are in this situation.